Hey everybody, this is DJ Q for the Golf News Met Radio Network. We now return you to Jay's Place, already in progress.
All right, everybody, we're back. Thank you, DJ Q, for bringing us back in style. Also, big thank you to Phish for giving us permission to use their music as the theme song for the show. That is First Tube from Madison Square Garden, actually, in 09. So I love grooving to that song. That one comes up in my running mix a lot, guys. For those of you just checking in, I ran 15K today, and I'm not hurting at all. I actually feel great. I'm telling you guys, this running stuff, I'm falling in love with it. It's like the Grateful Dead of sports, okay? Everybody's in a good mood. Everybody's, like, sort of dressed festively. Everybody's all friends. You know, everybody's all supportive of each other and helping each other, and there's just this great ethos to it.
Hey, you guys, the last two guys from New York who ran 15 miles, one of them they shot dead, the other one they wounded and took into custody, so you probably should be careful with her.
Well, we are up in the North Country too, yeah.
Well, on the flip side of that, Jay, is I've run 6 marathons in my life, so I know exactly what you're talking about. So it's a great individual achievement when you can run that far and survive, that's for sure.
Yeah, I've got that 15K coming up in 2 weeks. We ran the entire course today. My legs weren't as sharp as I'd hoped they were. I'd run 7 miles on Saturday. But I gotta tell you, guys, I had 2 fantastic runs out in Washington State. What a terrific trip, okay? I do want to throw a shout-out to my concierge, okay, to my posse that was waiting for me. Okay, I astroturfed a posse completely by accident. Or I guess a pal of mine astroturfed a posse for me, complete with a concierge, okay? I assume both of you recall Doss Boat, the huge boat that I stayed on, I showed you pictures of.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the movie. I was hoping you were really in that same submarine.
No, I was the one doing the torpedoing. Gary, we had this giant 70-foot yacht owned by a buddy of mine who's a new buddy of mine. He wasn't my buddy before this, but he is now. He's a jazz promoter. Two big concerts, you know, one in L.A. and one in Oregon. And he knew the law firm that I worked at for 3 years because I worked at the number one jazz firm in the world. I was Alan Bergman's associate. It was a great place to work. And so I stayed with those guys most of the week, stayed a couple of days with Jeff Shelley's Cybergolf. Big shout out to all of my Cybergolf pals, and in particular to Tony Deere, who I spent the week writing with. And of course, Marino Paracenzo, the man with a double breaking putt for a last name. Anyway, let's talk a little bit more about the tournament. A fantastic winner, strange ending, sort of a balloony pin ending. You know, tell us each your individual stories of where you were watching it unfold.
Well, I was in the media center because that's where you had to be because you really couldn't see anything out there. And it was great because, you know, everybody knows the story. Spieth makes the putt at 16, another clutch putt for him. And you think it's over, including he did too. And then that's the beauty of this golf court. 17, he misses the green and he winds up making a double, which he just didn't see coming. Now all of a sudden, everybody's back in it. 2 ties and just misses an eagle putt. Then Dustin Johnson makes a birdie. I mean, he's won it. Spieth has won it. He loses it. He might not get it. He doesn't make his eagle putt on 18. He may have lost it again, and he winds up winning it. It was like a ping pong match of emotions, and that's what everyone's going to remember. They're not going to remember the first 69 holes. They remember those last 3 holes and all the drama that happened there, and you know, it says a lot about those 3 holes.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in here before you, Bruce, to say it's actually the last 4 holes. They're all half par holes, and that's what makes them so great. The swings, that's another reason why Chambers Bay must stay in the Rota. It has just enough birdie and eagle opportunities to give you a little bit more excitement and a little more movement up and down the leaderboard, especially at the end. That was one of the geniuses of the routing, okay? The sturdy backbone of the course comes early at 4-8, but all the drama, the sexiness, you know, the sex appeal comes at the end for a big bang, a great crescendo. So tell us your story, Bruce.
Well, I tell you what, Jay, you hit it right on the head. I mean, one of my stories, I mean, I'll tell a story in a half if I could, but I had the opportunity Monday morning, bright and early, 5:30 in the morning, to go out with Mike Davis and John Bodenhammer with the USGA and kind of just be a fly on the wall, so to speak, watch them do the setup for the golf course and where they had all the pin positions figured out for every day. And then they would have a basically a matrix, depending on the wind, how those things might change. But and it was by design, believe me, that Mike Davis had it by design to have that theater on Sunday to really start at the 14th tee. And coming downhill and coming home, he wanted to see the ability for huge shot swings throughout the tournament. So I was extremely pleased to see that happen. The other thing about Sunday, I was in the grandstands on 13 most of the day in behind, like Gary said, it was a great place to be. I got there early enough and watched every group come through. And, you know, the ability to hear these roars throughout the golf course with no trees and wide open, you just heard these roars and it was fantastic. And then you got the big run by Rory and then the big run by Snedeker and people like that. So after the last group went through, my wife and daughter and I, we walked up on the top of the site and ended up going up to the USGA hospitality at the top of the rim. And then watch the finishing holes from there. And the funny part about that was that it was strange because we were watching TV, watching Dustin Johnson putt, and before he even took back the putter, we heard the groan from down on the 18th grandstands. So we knew that he had missed the putt before we ever saw it on TV. That's one thing I'll remember. It was just an amazing place to see that how much golf course you can see from the top. It was quite an experience.
Yeah, the roars are the magic of the tournament. I always get an electric charge out of that. One of my favorite moments was I was walking past 17 at Whistling Straight on Friday. And you'll remember, well, you won't, Bruce, but Gary will remember that pretty little Minnesota apple that I used to take around in the Midwest. It showed up from occasionally from tournament to tournament with me. So we were walking past 17, and all of a sudden, a roar breaks out like you never heard before, like a railroad racing by. And I said to her, I said, that sounds like a hole-in-one. She goes, how do you know? I go, you can tell. And sure enough, when we checked, it was Layman's hole-in-one. You know, but that's an inimitable roar. Like that same thing, I was in the locker room when Tiger made his putt at Torrey Pines, and we heard the roar. It was right on top of us. It was like getting run over by an avalanche, and there's still the 13-second delay on the television. But my story is I happened to be in the right place at the right time. Luckily, the one thing, good thing about the media badge is that, you know, we're allowed to walk into the grandstands at any time for any reason. And so I went to 16 a few groups early and parked my rear end down and watched, you know, like five or six groups come through, 16, including all the leaders, with the exception of Dustin. We went, when Jordan made that putt and when Gracie blocked it OB, I went so far as to tweet, ball game. And, you know, then 10 minutes later I had to tweet, hold the phone. Because all of a sudden, Jordan just turned into like one of my dad's foursome or one of my lug nut entertainment law buddies on the golf course. You know, just hitting it sideways. And so I went in to the media center right after Steve made his birdie and parked my rear end down next to the British broadcasters because they were not on the 13-second delay. Gary, you must have been in the room when this happened. Do you recall as Dustin stood up to go putt his putt, circus putt, that all the screens in the media tent went out and we were all looking at those little televisions they provided us on the side?
But yeah, it was, you know, it was great because everybody, when he missed the putt, everybody groaned and for like 1.8 seconds. And then they realized, because they groaned because, oh, the guy missed a short. And then they realized, we're not trying to make Monday. And turned from a groan to like, hey. You know?
Sort of, it did, yeah. Although, to me, it kind of sounded like, you know, that they were a little disappointed because Spieth versus Johnson would have been pretty cool, and kind of nobody wanted to see Johnson miss it like that.
No, nobody. You'd always rather have somebody win a tournament. You know, I wrote a follow-up on that because they had a shot tracker list, but Dustin Johnson, he missed 8 putts from 9 feet or less that final round.
That's it.
Gee,
like,
really?
Just like five inside of 6 feet.
Yep.
So you sit there and say, yeah, that putt cost them. Well, you know what? That was one of 8 putts that Jordan probably would have made 7 of them at least. Dustin Johnson could have won this thing by 5. Easy.
And here's another stat for you. He's won 159 on the tour in putting less than 10 feet. So if he's had any bad looks throw away, he can throw him in a mirror. And I do have to say, I was disappointed that he sat out the award ceremony. Bad form, especially for a guy coming off a suspension.
Well, he doesn't have anybody helping him. And, you know, I really think, and I don't really know anything about how good of a caddy his brother is, but people said, what does Dustin Johnson need? I said, I'll tell you what, if you put Stevie Williams on his bag as his caddy and told Dustin to listen, do whatever Stevie says, I think he'd win 6 majors before you knew what happened. But his decision making is not one of his strong suits.
Well, and Gary, I think
Williams out for good. Is he never coming back?
Well, he caddied for Adam Scott, who, you know, not surprisingly made a run on Sunday. So he's just kind of doing the major. You know, he just wanted to do the majors and the big tournaments. And Adam Scott told him, you know, that's not, I got to have somebody the rest of the year. It's not fair to get the other somebody else and then have you come in the summer. So they said, fine. And they got a different guy. And he fortunately got another guy who was kind of like Adam, not very aggressive or forceful. And it didn't work at all. And he putted badly. So he out of desperation, went back to Stevie for this summer. And, you know, guess what? He started, he made a run. So I think Stevie, if they can work out a deal where he can just do the big events, the majors, and maybe a couple other ones, I think Stevie would keep his hand in it. But he doesn't want to be gone 30 week a year. He wants to be gone like 6 or 8, and that's it. So,
well, your idea for him on Dustin's bag was a great idea, because the one thing that Dustin's missing is a head.
Yeah, he's got a lot of shots. He just needs somebody to tell him what to hit when.
Well,
somebody wrote a story, I think it was in Golf Week, and criticized him for trying to make that putt at 18 and when he should have lagged.
I disagree.
You get a chance to win the Open.
Yeah.
To try to make the putt. It didn't go that far by.
For goodness sake,
yeah.
Okay.
Do you think you're going to come back Monday and out-putt Jordan Spieth for the championship? I don't think so.
You might out
to do it right now. Well, you might, but it's also about putting, and the best putt, I mean, that's a mismatch there if there ever was one. So
that's true.
I think you try to make the putt, and, you know, if you can't make a 4-footer, then, you know, that's your problem. So,
your point, guys, like, to your point, is how important was Jordan Spieth's caddy that week? I mean, Michael knew that golf course left and right. That guy had caddied at Chambers Bay all these years. I think that was as much of a feather in Jordan's cap as anything. He had inside knowledge of how that golf course played.
Yeah, I picked him to win for that reason alone and wrote it and said, if his caddy's worth a shot or a shot and a half a day, then
yeah,
the rest
exactly.
of the field starting 6 shots back. They got a problem. They're not going to catch up to him. And they did.
Yep.
Although they gave it a heck of a try. How about Louis Westhuizen with a 29 on the back?
Yeah, I tell you what, I was up in the stands on 13, and talk about one of those hole-in-one roars, you know, because we can look down and see where the position in the fairway that those guys were hitting their shots into. And I saw Louis swing, and the crowd behind that green in that grandstand went nuts, and then the caddies started going nuts. And that was one of those moments you go, what did he do? Did he just knock that in? And you know, he had just missed a very makeable putt. On the green right in front of us. So, I mean, what he did on the last round, I mean, you know, once again, where's Louis' major championship? St. Andrews. I wonder if he likes that kind of golf. So,
my heart breaks for him for one reason. I've never heard of a guy holing out 2 different times in a final round of a major and losing both times.
Yeah.
You're normally the guy that holds out wins.
Yeah,
that's a good point.
Okay, first, Angel Cabrera, Okay, West High is a double legal two. The last of the holes to finally be double legal, the top five. Double legal's two on a three wood that took a right turn at Albuquerque and rolled 100 feet in. Okay, and he gets beat in the playoff. And then to have this happen to him, he bogeyed three of the first four holes, not the kind of start that you want. You know, well, it's kind of put him behind the eight ball, but what a run at the end.
Wasn't he seven over?
Yeah, he was like nine over after 20 holes, yeah. So he just dug himself a hole. Otherwise, he'd have been right there, too. You know, I thought the USGA got that set up exactly perfect on Sunday. I think it took them a couple days to get a handle on it because I thought Saturday they were close to the course kind of getting away from them. Sunday they set it up so you couldn't make birdies if you hit good enough shots, as it really proved. And I think it took USGA a few days to, or maybe they wanted to be tougher, but, you know, they had just the right mix Sunday, whereas Saturday I thought, yeah, maybe they didn't quite get it. But, you know, give them a few more shots at this track, and I think they'll be better off.
As I like to say, let them play golf for the title, okay? And that's what they did when you ease up on the throttle just a bit. They did the same thing for Rory at Congressional, and he set a record for him. You know, so occasionally, and I thought that it would have served them well to do that at Marion with all those great names on that leaderboard, and instead they made it really, really, really hard. You know, and the one nice thing I like about Chambers Bay is the guy that wins on Sunday is going to have, you know, five birdies and three bogeys. He's not going to have 18 pars, and that's more exciting.
Well, it's maybe counterintuitive, and you know, it's just my opinion, but if you look at major history, the lowest scoring majors are usually the one by the best players in the game, and the lower the score, the better the winner generally, and the higher the score, that's when you get some of the, you know, unusual winners. So, you know, I think you want to let guys, if you make it so hard that nobody can make birdie except by accident, you've equalized the field, you've negated ability, you lose advantage, and that's when, you know, you have Sean McKeel at Oak Hill winning an 8-inch rough because nobody could do anything. And you can go back to the 70s and 80s. The USGA made those mistakes a lot of time during the PGA Boatright era. It's a scrambling contest. Landy North being the top five scramblers of all time. No wonder he won a couple of, I've seen him go through a greenside bunker, hit every iron in the bag from start of sandwich down to three iron, and you can't hardly tell the difference. He can get up and down. He's one of the greatest lag putters ever, which used to be important in U.S. Open. He's got some skills, but, you know, hitting the ball straight off the tee was not one of them, but he can get the ball in the hole. So, Bruce, I don't know what you think, but to me, I'd even think Chambers Bay, maybe the winning score could have been better even at 10 or 12 or 13 under, but, you know, it certainly worked out great the way it is.
Well, remember, we didn't get any weather either, though. They had four nice days, okay, and there was hardly any wind to speak of.
That was going to be my point also, Jay, is that, and you got very warm, unusual temperatures. And Gary hit it earlier in the conversation that, you know, hey, if we've gotten a little bit of rain like Seattle normally gets, you know, 2 days before the tournament or even one night during the tournament, you know, that golf course would have played a lot different. And then throw wind in the equation, you know, if it was softer, the golfers might have used slopes a little bit differently. But if we got wind in the equation, boy, you know, gauging the wind, and then what happens when the ball hits the ground? There's a double whammy. So, you know, there's no doubt that the Chambers Bay is the kind of golf course that in certain areas you can get aggressive and you can go low. And I was very happy to see that the USGA set it up to entertain that.
Now, I'll tell you something else that concerns me, though, is generally speaking, the attitudes of golfers. Let's just say that some British Open weather rolled through, you know, a Chambers Bay U.S. Open. They would have cried and moaned and bellyached about that. Man, we don't play in this crap in Florida. It's supposed to be a U.S. Open. Okay. Meanwhile, when Royal Birkdale has tents get blown over by, you know, wind storms, everyone's like, yeah, British Open weather. You know, why is it so holy and noble and perfect over there? But why does no one let it translate over here? At least not, you know, people other than architecture aficionados and ardent golfers.
Well, you can't explain that any more than you can explain the fact that Rory McIlroy, the number one player in the world, is from Northern Ireland, and he doesn't like playing in the rain or the wind. So I can only assume he was adopted because if he grew up in Northern Ireland with that attitude, he must. I mean, I don't know. I just can't explain it.
I played 36 holes in the rain this weekend. Granted, it was a warm rain and it was only sprinkling, but it was fun. It wasn't really all that enjoyable because it was kind of soggy conditions. But we played 18 one day, and then get this, you guys will love this, especially you, Bruce, play cross-country golf. Okay,
oh,
so
yeah.
You tee off on one tee, play three green. Tee off on four tee, play down to two green. Tee off on six, play to 17 green. Go back to the 11th tee, which is right there, play down to 16. It was wild. So we played cross-country golf. We tee off on one tee, play some other different green. It was a ton of fun. We hopscotched all over the golf course. There was nobody on the course. There were lots of weddings and graduation days. Or the weather chased everybody away, but literally my buddy and I had the course to ourselves, so we were able to do like a whole, sheep ranch. We were able to do the whole sheep ranch thing, if you guys get the reference.
Yep, exactly. I used to do that in our course back in Iowa growing up. It was wide open and, it would rain like crazy or thunderstorm like crazy and everybody would go into the clubhouse. Me and my buddies, we would go out and just start playing golf holes every direction, 720 yard holes with two dog legs and all kinds of stuff. It's a lot of fun to do that.
Gary, your thoughts on cross country golf?
It sounds great. I've never really tried it because, and other people on the golf course, they tend to frown on that. But, I know at my home course in Pittsburgh, my son's a professional trying to make it on the web.com tour. And, he's invented his own golf course. He puts the tee back across the road on number one and adds 70 yards to it because he hits it a mile. And he plays, he's got his own little course that he's created. It's not necessarily cross country, but he's modified the course so he can hit driver a little bit more. And it's kind of cool. I just wish I could hit it. Try not to try that thing with him. I can't hit it. I can't carry it 300 yards to do some of the stuff he does. But, there's a show on Golf Channel now where they're going cross country and combining fitness and speed or something. And I've only seen the commercials. I can't quite figure out what's going on. But I think it's the same concept. And I think it's kind of a cool idea. I'd like to catch an episode of that and see if they're really going cross country all the time or what they're doing. But let's go through a mall while we're at it. Let's have some excitement.
Well, what you want to do? But by the way, Gary, what's the name of this course in Pittsburgh? You remember?
It's Treevale Golf and Country Club. It's a club course designed by Arnold Palmer. So that's probably all you need to know.
Okay, I'm biting my tongue right now.
As Gary Player would say most of the time, it's the finest course of its kind. He didn't say it all the time, apparently, but Gary forgot it. Apparently Gary forgot that line during the Open, but that's okay. He should have said, by the way, in addition to my previous comments, I didn't get the contract to build the course, but that has nothing to do with my opinion of the place.
Well, okay. He's got nothing to say, okay? He posed naked in a stupid magazine at age 70. And I'm sorry to say what everybody was thinking, but he looked fat, okay? I'm sorry, but he did. He looked flat. So, you know what? You can stick it right in your bottle. Anyway, getting back to brass tacks, I was very disappointed in the intemperance of his remarks about Chambers Bay as well, okay? I thought it was unnecessary to deal with an over-the-top and a quintessential example of, putting that out of the major broadcast and letting everybody hear it, just it really, was an afterthought. And it was over the top. And why is it so holy and perfect to do this at Pinehurst last year, where we all had a genuflect, yet every time someone hit an iron shot, a puff of smoke or a cloud of dust came out of the ground, but it's not okay here? Why is it? Is it that it's one John Lawson, one Robert Sanchez Jr., or is it that one's 100 years old and one is 70?
I don't have an answer. I just think it's not what they're used to, and people.
Exactly.
People just don't want something different. They want, they never, going back to Jay's earlier point, does anybody ever like the U.S. Open? I remember Johnny Miller saying when I used to ghostwrite his stuff for Golf World magazine, he said the Masters is fun. The U.S. Open isn't fun. It's not supposed to be fun. And therefore, as we commented, the complaining is usually quite loud because it's not supposed to be a fun experience. It's supposed to be test you in every part of your game, and it's supposed to test you mentally and whether you're tough enough to, you know, survive and endure all these bad breaks and bad shots and bad bounces. And you know, it's supposed to frustrate you. And if you let that bother you, then you know you're not going to be the U.S. Open champion. And that's just part of it. I just think people aren't expecting that, and they, you know, and they forget that this tournament's supposed to be different.
Well, and it's all about mental toughness. I know that's what I know in spending a lot of time around Mike Davis walking around Chambers Bay. He wanted the aspect of mental toughness to be a big part of what the champion's skill level need to be. In fact, that's one of the things he loved about Chambers Bay so much is all the flexibility that the canvas of Chambers Bay gave him. And I think Tiger hit it very, very well when he had a press conference early in the week. He says, I counted 34 golf holes out there. And how do you prepare for that? You know, you have to prepare for each type of shot, each type of hole. And that, to me, is a test of a great player where they have to go out and they have to look at different ways to play at different holes, and it's just not set up the same way every day. And I know Mike, from a personality's perspective, loves to have that aspect of the game come to the forefront. And I think Chambers Bay was a great place for him to exercise that.
Bruce, do you realize you're the first guy this year to utter the sentence, Tiger hit it very well? That sentence has not been said all year. You're the first one.
Well, Tiger's a smart guy. Tiger's a smart guy. He's designing his own golf courses, and I think he was reading it right. So I applauded him when I heard him say that. So.
Giving credit where credit is due, yeah, he is probably the smartest guy going out and mapping a golf course. And he definitely works very hard at it. So, you know.
You bet.
And he is pretty sharp, you know. One wishes that he was able to keep the rest of his life in his apple pie order. But again, you know, the griping was a little over the top. But the golf course, it was the way it played, and it played terrific. The flexibility is what makes it so much fun. You know, it's a very astute analysis. With regards to all of the angles that you can attack, or the holes that can be made longer or shorter, Mike Davis has added an extra dimension. My favorite example of which was the 16th tee at Olympic Club when he put it way forward and everybody had to, you know, had to hit a screaming hook to get it into that fairway.
Yep.
Come for the golf, stay for the train. You know, it's what's not to like.
Anyway, guys, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a ton of fun having you. And really great discussion, everybody. We had some terrific analysis of both Chambers Bay and the tournament. You guys were fantastic.
Anytime, Jay. Had a blast.
It was great being had, as usual.
Everybody stick around. We're going to have Bruce Moulton coming up in a little while, and we're going to have John Garrity coming up in a while. You're listening to Jay's Plays on the Golf News Network. Radio Network. This is Jay Plum on the side of golf. We will catch you guys in just a couple minutes. We're going to leave you in the very capable hands of my main man, DJ Q. We're at the end of another great Jay's Play show, but thank you all so much for joining in. It's no fun doing this to an empty room, but it sure is fun doing it for all of you guys, so thanks so much. I want to thank Fish for kindly letting me use their great music as a theme song for the show. Thanks, guys. I want to thank CyberGolf and Golf News Network, cybergolf.com/writerscorner, including me and all the other fine writers, and thegolfnewsnet.com/radio. Take us home, DJ Q.
Tune in next time for another great Jay's Play show on the Golf News Net Radio Network.
Thanks, guys. Catch y'all next time.